morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Office Hours. I'm your host, Daniel Pink, broadcasting from our state-of-the-art nerve center here in Washington, D.C. Here's how Office Hours works. On each program, we open the phone lines for an hour, and I, accompanied by a special guest, about which more in a moment, will take your questions, questions about work, business, life, management, education, creativity, sports, romance, anything you want. Like we say, if you have questions, we have answers. And when we don't have answers, we'll make something up. And today we've got I'm really fortunate about the guests we've been able to collect here so far. We've got another terrific guest to go with the previous awesome guest we've had, Bob Sutton. Now, for those of you who don't know him, Bob teaches at Stanford University, where he holds a dual appointment in both the engineering school and the business school there at Stanford. Stanford is a place that I consider the Northwestern of California. He's also one of the founders of the B School, the amazing multidisciplinary program that teaches design thinking. And one of the things I like about Bob is that he is a boundary crosser. He's a serious scholar. So, you know, you see his research on innovation and organizational behavior and management in the top academic journals. But he's also very skilled at writing for a popular audience. His blog, and I imagine a lot of the listeners who are still really pouring in here, it's quite remarkable. You've got quite a following, Bob. The listeners who are pouring in here are follow Bob's blog. It's one of my favorites. It's really smart, really interesting. And Bob is really prolific in the length and volume of his postings, which is sort of annoying, but that's another story. He's written several books, among them The Knowing Doing Gap, Weird Ideas That Work, the mega bestseller, The No Asshole Rule, here and after referred to as the No A-Hole Rule, since we know that school children around the world are listening to this broadcast, and his latest bestseller, Good Boss, Bad Boss. For all you do, Bob, to contribute to the world and enlighten us, thank you and welcome to Office Hours.
Well, it's great to be here. I'm very excited to talk to you.
You sound it, Bob. You sound.
This is more fun than the average radio show.
That's actually not a bad tagline. You know, because our tagline was "Car Talk for the Human Engine."
I like that.
You like that? I like that too. You know what? It's not really taking the world by storm.
Really?
I'm waiting for the cease and desist letter from Click and Clack, but it hasn't arrived yet. I like more fun than the average radio show, and I think it will be. I also think it'll be more interesting, more life-changing, and in its own perverse way, more substantive. Now, Bob, where are you right now? Tell me where you are right now.
So I'm in my house in Menlo Park, California, and I'm sitting in my quite messy garage. The reason I'm in the garage is that we bought a house with three bedrooms and I guess four bedrooms, and one for each child was, and the study for me was the theory, but then about 15 years ago, this other kid came along, so I was moved into the garage, and I've been here ever since. I go to Stanford, too, but this is where I write and do other things.
Interesting. Well, I have a somewhat similar situation in our previous house. Actually, my wife lost her office to a child. I had my office pretty much intact, but my wife lost her home office to our son. And now, though, we moved to a different house only about a mile away, and we have this old garage back in the days here in Washington, D.C., you know, with this old stodgy Washington, D.C., people still have one-car garages. I think that's illegal in California to have a one-car garage.
I think it's illegal not to have less than two or three cars, probably.
Yeah. They won't let you build a one. So we have this old one-car garage that we – converted into my office, and it's really cool. It has great soundproofing for Office Hours, which is really the key building criterion that we use. but it also makes me feel like just like a little bit of Silicon Valley here in the nation's capital by, you know, this little venture here in the garage. But anyway, enough about me, folks. I got a lot to talk to Bob about. Okay, so I have to say I'm gonna elbow some of you aside, but let me explain to you how you can. I'm sorry, I'm going to do that. I'm the host. I'm going to explain to you how you ask questions here. So if you want to ask a question, this is the folks listening in, and we really do have, I was talking to Bob a little bit off air, We really do have an incredible – we don't have many international listeners that I can detect right here, but we have a really incredible mix across the United States. I mean, from Keller, Texas, to State College, Pennsylvania, to San Mateo, to Richmond, Virginia, to Winterset, Iowa, Boise, Idaho, Oakland. Quite amazing. So
fabulous.
So anyway – so here we go. So folks, those of you listening out there, if you want to ask a question, here's how it works on office hours. If you want to ask a question, you do the virtual equivalent of raising your hand. And you do that by pressing star two, okay, star two. That will allow our crack team of producers to see you on the control panel. And what I'll do is I can see either your name or your location or both, and I'll say, you know, Fred from St. Louis, you're on the air, and you can ask away. Now, here's what's important, because we've run into this problem before. Press star 2 if you have a question. If you don't have a question, think of a question and then press star 2. We had some people who were so dutiful and apparently so mesmerized by the dulcet tones of my voice. When I said press star 2, several people just pressed star 2. And when I asked them, hey, you're on the air, they said, what? Oh, I just pressed star 2. So just press star 2 if you have a question, okay? And it can be about anything, because Bob actually has a range of things. And then also last episode, we started getting questions. This is kind of cool, Bob. We started getting questions organically via Twitter. That is, people began talking about it on Twitter and asking themselves, hey, what – so that was kind of cool. And so if you want to ask a question via Twitter, just go to @Daniel – just include @DanielPink. And we will monitor that. But anyway, before we go to the phones, I do want to. We already have people with their hands up. Oh yeah, yeah.
Great.
But I go first. I want to give listeners a sense of the breadth of Bob's ideas. So I've got some questions of my own, Bob. And what I want to do is is kind of move quickly through a few parts of your oeuvre, if you'll pardon my French, and tease out some of the big ideas there. So let's start with this book, The Knowing Doing Gap, because this is a big issue. So tell us, The Knowing Doing Gap, what is that?
Well, so The Knowing Doing Gap is it was the first book. This is probably about 1999, I guess, we published this, that I ever was involved in writing for that was aimed at managers. Before that, I'd only actually written for very small and academic small academic audiences and wrote obtuse stuff. But my colleague Jeff Effer, who I'm still doing stuff with, actually, we've been spending the morning sort of plotting a new article. And so Jeff sort of came up to me and he said, you know, have you noticed, we were both doing a lot of executive education, that one of the most typical conversations you have with groups of executives are, they tell you about this thing they know their organization should do, but there's something about the system they're part of that makes it difficult or impossible to turn knowledge into action. And so eventually we started calling this the Knowing Doing Gap, and we spent a few years doing research on it. And in the book, we talk about a bunch of causes and cures, things like one of my favorite sort of causes is something called the smart talk trap, which is a situation where people say smart things as sort of a substitute for doing them. A topic, by the way, since you and I
that's actually the business case behind this program, Bob.
That is, that we will use talk as a substitute for action. Well, that's one of the ironies, of course, is I hate to say it, but I've made a fair amount of money talking about the fact people should be doing stuff rather than doing it myself. So I am guilty of it as well. But even that sign is a sign that those of us who talk about business, and this includes consulting firms, they're guilty as well, often get paid more than the people who actually do it. But I'm as guilty as they are, so I shouldn't be too critical.
Yeah.
So that was the Knowing Doing Gap, and that's a book that we still continue to talk about. And in Good Boss, Bad Boss, there in fact is a new chapter that sort of updates the smart talk trap, but it's the same basic idea.
Yeah. It seems like it's an issue that haunts a lot of organizations. That is, they sort of know the right thing to do. It's just
right.
For whatever reason, they can't do it, and it's a curious mix of why that is. I'm convinced that some of it is a form of, it depends on the circumstance, some of it's a form of learned helplessness.
Yeah, sometimes it's a form of learned helplessness. And there are some organizations in some situations where you actually get punished for doing things. And the way you get
right.
ahead is either by shooting down other people's ideas and or just sort of proposing things. And as an example, I would say that academia suffers from that in particular. But I was actually shocked to discover that people in for-profit organizations also suffer from this problem. So, Dan, have you ever published a book?
Have I ever published a book?
Yeah. Haven't you published a few books?
Yeah, I have. I have. Yeah, let me just
check the
shelf.
Yeah.
Yes,
so my hypothesis,
my
hypothesis is that that publishers suffer from this disease even more than academics do. The number of things they told me they were going to do and they didn't do just is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And I've had multiple publishers, and they're all guilty.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's. I think that's kind of interesting. I think the idea. I mean, again, I apologize, all of you listeners out there with your hands up. Just hang on a second, all right? I'm going to get to you. I don't want the folks, you know, the folks out there with their hands up, including some. Do you know where Canoga Park, California, is, Bob?
I think it's in Southern California somewhere.
Southern California. I just like Canoga. That's just a nice sounding word, Canoga.
It is a nice sounding word. I think you're pronouncing it correctly, even.
Well, how else would you pronounce that?
I don't know. I think you're doing it right.
Canoga? No, it cannot possibly be pronounced Canoga. That's just it's just inconceivable in the English language. Anyway, but I think your point about shooting stuff down is very, very interesting too, because. And I want to emphasize the word smart in the smart talk trap, because a lot of times people demonstrate their smarts in a kind
right.
of being able to deconstruct, and they sort of get they show how smart they are by being able to deconstruct something wobbly. When I've always thought, and this is my experience being, I mean, as you know, Bob, I was actually trained as I hate to even say that word because it sounds like a dog. I was trained as a little. I was trained.
I know. I'm married to one too. They're everywhere. Aren't you married to?
Yeah.
A lawyer
no.
Too?
I'm married. I'm married to a lawyer too. I mean, just for your listeners, it's not the same person. But I'm married to a lawyer as well. And one of the things, I'm sorry, my wife who is sitting here with me, this just scribbled down. We can put you on because I've been wanting my wife to be the Ed McMahon of this thing here. But she said former. She wrote in letters here next to me, former.
My wife's a former lawyer too. She's now CEO of the Girl Scouts of Northern California. She switched careers about 3 years ago. It's been very radical.
This is incredible. The similarities. We're going to empty. There's going to be no one left on this program besides you and me.
More than the tears.
The similarity. We are just going to empty. We're going to do the virtual equivalent of emptying the room here. Not only do we both work in garages, not only are we married to former lawyers, but my wife was a Girl Scout.
Wow.
And, she's waving me off. She was a Girl Scout. How many? How high in the ranks of the Girl Scout did you? Did you get like Commandant or something?
At least Brown.
The Gold Award.
I don't know what the ranks are. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and the Boy Scouts were a big thing. And I was like, I actually told my parents that I would want to be a conscientious objector to the Boy Scouts.
I dropped out eventually.
Yeah. No, it's just not my. It was just not my thing. Those uniforms are. Anyway. But it's a good thing. We like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. We like Scouts of every kind. Moving along here. But I think this idea of people deconstructing, showing their smarts rather than constructing, mm-hmm. because to me, it takes actually a much more sophisticated form of intelligence to look at something that is wobbly and say, how can I make it less wobbly? It's actually not that hard to look at something that's wobbly and say, here are the wobbly parts, ///, look at it fall down. And that always one of the things that annoyed me about law school, because people were very, very good at that.
And lawyers are good at that.
Yeah, that's what they do. Give you one. I want my lawyer to be good at that. But I think that that's not the sort of behavior necessarily you bring to bear in every kind of setting. I've gotten through the first book and we're already running out of time. So let me ask you about the second. Another book here, and then we're going to go take some callers, people who are
Sounds
waiting
good.
Patiently. So Weird Ideas That Work. I like this book. I like this book a lot. I remember reading this, over 10 years ago, right? Or 10 years ago?
Right, yeah. So that's my worst-selling book, and therefore it's my favorite. I love that book.
Worst-selling book? How could that possibly be?
Well, there's, you know, there's five books. There's got to be a distribution.
That's true. Yeah.
It hit the stands. This was sort of my .com book, and it hit the stands like 2 weeks after September 11th. And I love it. Speaking of wives, my wife says, so you've got a book on weird ideas, and they took a group of, clients out to lunch, and they had tomato soup and grilled cheese sandwiches at a fancy restaurant. Everybody was like, going, we all remember what a terrible time to that. Everybody was going to the most basic traditions. But the basic idea of that book is that which is not an original idea. I stole it from a famous theorist named Jim March and others, is that the logic of doing creativity is much different than the logic of doing routine work. And when you look at the logic of creativity, there's a whole bunch of things you need to do that look like bad management, like I made the argument of hiring people you don't need, finding some happy people and getting them to fight.
I want to pick up on that because that's one of the things that I wrote down on. Tell us what you mean by that. So one of your pieces of advice from this weird idea is find some happy people and get them to fight.
So what that comes from –
why in God's name would you want to do that?
So where that comes from are sort of two intertwined bodies of literature with, by the way, there has been some updating of it, which is that people who tend to be – more creative tend to be the more optimistic types because when there's a setback, they tend to be more persistent. They tend to create positive self-fulfilling prophecies, which infect the people around them. And the get them to fight part is we now have a fairly large body of literature that shows that especially for creative work, that when people fight in an atmosphere of mutual respect, that they do a better job of sort of hashing out and developing ideas. And my poster child company for this would be Pixar, especially the director Brad Bird, who of Ratatouille and Incredibles fame, just does an amazing job of creating this sort of atmosphere of constructive conflict over ideas, but always moving forward. It's not that sort of brilliant but cruel stuff where you're just tacking ideas. You're always making it better, making a decision, moving forward. And that sort of model, to me, is the model of what great creative leaders and companies do.
But as you said, argument in an atmosphere of mutual respect. It's really that atmosphere of mutual respect that one has to underscore.
And no one when to stop, by the way, because Brad Bird's another good example of this. Like, they'll have an argument over, one of the things you can actually find, this is on video, is how bald to make Bob the superhero in The Incredibles. My name is Bob and I'm bald, so this was especially interesting to me. And it was a pretty big argument, but it was pretty short, too. They had a big argument, they made a decision, they went on. So that's just one sort of little example. And just as the contrary, the difference in logic is if you are having a routine surgical procedure or somebody is flying your commercial airplane, you do not want them having an argument about how to do it. You really don't.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's a really, really interesting point. And I think most organizations are not that great at doing that. You have people, I've seen almost in some ways the polar opposite, where it's fighting but without the mutual respect, or I think many cases kind of mutual respect and a timidity about disagreeing.
Right.
And neither one of those really fosters that creativity. All right, folks, I'm going to go to some questions here in a moment, but if anybody wants to, I got a lot more questions for Bob, but if anybody wants to ask a question, remember, all you have to do on your phone is hit *2, press *2, and we'll be able to see you with your hand raised as we see people there. And I'll say your name again, Jose in Sheboygan, and you'll be on the air. And then also, oops, I got to check, look at this Twitter feed, see if anything's coming up via, see if Mr. Twitter is sending us anything, or Ms. Twitter, or Monsignor Twitter is sending us anything. Let's go. Got a lot of calls here. So let's go to the first person in the queue. This is Amanda. Amanda in Seattle. Amanda, welcome to Office Hours.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. My
sure
question.
Oh, you have the whole radio convention thing going on, Amanda. I was expecting you to say, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, it's a first-time listener, so I can't, I can't claim that.
I
have to go back and listen to the other one.
What's your question?
My question is bad bosses, and I'm interested in what are the signs that somebody can be rehabilitated or can't be?
Oh, very interesting,
that's,
Bob.
That's really interesting. So Matt, I like this question because it's well, first of all, it's a tough judgment call to make. But to me, I would sort of get back to the self-awareness issue, which is that if somehow or another the person is aware that they've got confidence problems, then you might be okay. And it is sort of interesting. So I've got some colleagues, Frank Flynn and another guy named Daniel Ames, who do research on the degree to which bosses are assertive, so whether they're overbearing or they're sort of doormats. And I don't know if this is good news or bad news, but they've got some analysis, which they're still working on, but it apparently shows that the most overbearing, pushy sort of people tend to be more blind to their weaknesses, where the more doormats, the ones who aren't pushy enough, they tend to be more aware of it and therefore better cases for rehabilitation. So that's just
one little
sign. But to me, if they can become aware of it, and there's some signs that they actually have some trajectory and they can move forward and keep getting better, to me that's also a sign that there's hope. And then the final thing I would add as a practical matter is there's a big difference between if you're, let's just take, I just mentioned Pixar, if you're developing a director at Pixar, which is the most important position at Pixar, the people who direct the film, you have a long-term time horizon and you can allow for a lot of trial and error learning. If you're doing a startup and you've got 6 months to get a product out, and you've got a really horrible boss type, you probably don't have, to be realistic, you don't have time for development. So a lot of it depends on the time horizon you're under. Anything else,
Amanda? Is this an issue that you are facing in your own workplace?
It might be. Yeah.
I have a friend that too, Amanda.
But, you know, you said my name in city now, so.
Oh, come on. There are so, you know, there's so many Amandas in, I won't even say the city again. So, we do not out people here on office hours. But
okay.
I think it's so Bob, does that mean that the people, the overbearing cases are sort of beyond rehabilitation?
No, I'm enough of an academic to say it depends, just to say they're tougher cases. And just we're actually talking about our wives, and so I'll get in some trouble here and be indiscreet. My wife was for 8 years managing partner of a large law firm. And when you're managing partner of a large law firm, I won't say the name of it, but people would find out easily, and this is true for all managing partner, part of your job is asshole management. The fact is that partners in large law firms, a large percentage of them are assholes, at least 35%. And they're also sort of paid to be assholes. And she had this sort of analysis that there were two kinds. There were the clueless kinds and the strategic kinds. This is not in my book, by the way. And her perspective, and part of her job is managing partner, my wife being not a doormat, but somebody who will tend to tell especially difficult men the truth, being married to her, I know this. She's very good with difficult men. And she would give them the feedback. And sometimes in the process, they would be subtracting some money from their pay to their credit. There were two reactions. There was the people who couldn't believe it. They just couldn't believe what was happening to them. They were much more difficult to rehabilitate because, in fact, some of them still are assholes. But then there was the people who just thought strategically that's how you get ahead. And those people who were aware they were doing it and doing it on purpose, although in some ways they're deeper assholes because they're doing it on purpose, right? Knowingly. They actually were easier to reform because you just had to explain to them it wasn't in their best interest and maybe put some rewards and a little embarrassment along with it to change their behavior.
Interesting. Well, so a lot of this really goes to the issue of self-awareness.
Yes.
That is, you know, do you have a sense of self? Who are you doing? Although it's sort of this interesting almost philosophical conundrum that if someone, like the people who are legitimately assholes or the people who are pretending to be assholes, is pretending to be an asshole make you a bigger asshole than someone who's legitimately an asshole?
I can't tell the difference because to me it's all received behavior. Yeah. I'm not into intent.
Yeah.
I'm into effect.
That's
psychology.
And also, I think I read somewhere in some newsletter that I got that Stanford's going to have a subspecialty soon on asshole management. Is that right?
I don't think we have a subspecialty. I'm in the engineering school mostly, and for the most part, we're actually quite quite nice. And not that I know of, although occasionally we'll teach a class on being a good boss or a bad boss.
Stanford's a fairly, as compared to some other institutions on the other side of the United States, kinder and gentler.
Actually, to be honest, there's a difference between the way a Californian is an asshole and somebody in New York or in the East Coast is an asshole, which is
you have to expand on that. I'm sorry. We got other callers, but we need to hear this one. So, but I'm gonna thank Amanda for her call. Thank you,
Amanda.
And then Bob. We got the New York assholes and the California assholes. Bob, I know via Twitter. To the listeners who are on Twitter that Canoga Park is in Metro LA. Says Steve Q. Shannon. It's in Metro LA. It's among other things the home of Pratt Whitney. Rocket Dime. So I'm going to get to the and now I feel like I got to get to the Canoga Bar caller, but I will. But more than and we can. The first question we'll ask the Canoga Park one is: are you a New York asshole or a California asshole? But what's the difference?
I'm sorry.
What's the difference?
Well, the whole California thing. I grew up in the Midwest, but then moved out here, and in the Californians, they seem really nice, and then they do the backstabbing thing, you know, because it's like the perky, upbeat sort of California thing.
Yeah, interesting.
And this obviously is an oversimplification, as all theories are. And in Hollywood, there's a lot of more direct screaming. But in the East Coast, one thing that I actually do like about the East Coast in general is that you can actually tell where people stand. And it turns out, I think that Midwesterners, at least my experiences, are actually authentically nice as opposed to people on the coast. So
there's a little parochialism there, I'm sure. Where in the Midwest did you grow up?
I grew up in Chicago, which is – when I think of nice Midwesterners, though, I think of people from places like Ohio and Iowa and stuff like that.
Yes. As someone who was reared in Columbus, Ohio – And every Ohioan knows that you rear children and raise animals. Okay, I just want to make sure that I'm using that word carefully. As someone who was reared in Columbus, Ohio, I think you're right. I'll tell you one little – and I was actually in Columbus, Ohio this past weekend. And and people will just say hi to you. And as someone who's lived in the – I mean, it's kind of freaky. And as people who live – I mean, like you walk down the street, they'll say hi. And they just say hi to you. As someone who's lived on the East Coast basically my entire adult life, it's a little bit freaky. I remember my wife and I were out for a run in Columbus, Ohio once. Columbus, Ohio is a great place to run because it's so unbelievably flat. And so we're out for a run, and we're running through a neighborhood, and these people start – saying hi to us. Hi, good morning. Hi, good morning. It's like, oh my God, you know, what are they going to do? You know, you keep looking back over your shoulder and you realize, oh my God, actually people are just kind of nice. That's a good thing. So, we'll get some Midwestern callers, but first let's go to, we're going to go to our friend in Canoga Park.
Canoga Park. Great.
You're on the air, Canoga.
Oh, I think that would be me then.
I guess so.
So,
hi, welcome to Office Hours. What's your question? Tell us your first name.
Andy.
Andy from Canoga Park. What's your question here on Office Hours?
So, well, I want to clarify your previous statement. I have actually lived in both New York and California.
We need you, Andy, to weigh in on Bob's finely honed anthropological distinction.
With very little evidence, by the way.
As a Wisconsin boy, I don't like saying bad things about either place.
That is so noble.
That is – I think we have just been – this is the anything you can do, I can do meta argument line of argument here. So very nice. Well played, Andy. Well played. I wish we had prizes on this show to give to you. But Andy,
hopefully you have answers.
So what do you do in Canoga Park?
I'm an executive in a small TPA firm. So we we manage the – we do the plan design and administration for retirement plans. So
interesting.
Yeah, if you think accountants are boring, deal with TPAs.
No, there are all kinds of – actually, there are actually some really interesting going to sort of Bob's specialty in – the juncture of business and behavior and design, there's some really fascinating things on how do you design those kinds of programs so that people do the right thing. But anyway, we can talk more about that, but what's your question?
So my question, and it has to do something with the structure of the business, and I'd be interested in both of your thoughts because I read both of your blogs religiously. But historically, we have always promoted star performers to become managers and executives, and we've always pushed them to time splice. So they need to continue producing big numbers, and they need to be managers because they were our star producers.
Right.
We've now reached a size where we need them to do less production themselves but more management. And in trying to get people to make those types of changes, what are the things that you guys would look for that would concern you or that you would do to try and encourage people to do management functions that they're not that comfortable doing?
It's a great – Bob, I have a few thoughts to weigh in, but tell us what you think about that.
Well, first of all, Andy, this is a classic thing, and it's actually a sign of success when an organization grows enough that you've got to start having people becoming full-time managers or somewhere close to it. And it's good that you're promoting people who actually understand the work that they manage, since that is a disease that many organizations have. But two things come to mind, and I'd be curious what Dan has to offer. The first thing is that there is this tendency to believe, and by the way, law firms are a great example who make this mistake all the time, and so does academia, is they think that the better the individual performer is, the more the star they are in the particular whatever the craft is, that person will be a better manager. What I would look for is, in particular, people who tend to have a sense of the business as a whole. And another thing which causes problems in academia and in law firms, too, and other places, is be especially wary of the people who really look at everybody as a competitor, because those are the people who have probably stomped on the people around them a lot on the way up. So that's one thing. And then the other thing that I guess that I would say about management, and this is something that the old Hewlett Packard was really good at, but in general, management is something that takes people a while to learn. So be a little bit patient with them in the beginning and try to provide them with some mentoring. It's not like people are instantly good at it. It is something that takes a while to learn. So I guess those are my two reactions.
Yeah, and I think that there are some people who – I mean, Bob, you might disagree with this, but I think there are some people who just are not cut out to be managers.
Oh, sure.
They're so good at the individual contribution, and you can actually really destroy their job satisfaction by doing this. You see this very much in Andy's talking about production sort of, I guess, in more of the financial services sense. But you see this big time in creative and technical fields where – the top technical person, oh my God, you're awesome, we're going to make you a manager, and then she ends up watching people do what she loves to do rather than do what she loves to do. And so I've always thought, and you see a few of the kind of technology firms doing this, what do you do with your star performers when you have to find a place for them that's beyond simply being an individual contributor, but they're not really cut out for being managers? And a few of the, you know, technology firms do things like senior scientists or that sort of stuff.
Right.
And I've always thought there was a better, sort of a more expansive role like that that could be filled. And the other thing, it's interesting what you said about being a competitor, because my suggestion was to think about sort of get a sense either through actual survey data or by just nosing around is whether people want to be on a team or part of a project with that person. I've always thought that there are, and there isn't at least that I know of, a great mechanism for measuring this. There are some people whose presence makes other people perform better. There are some people whose presence makes other people perform worse. And I'd love to have a kind of a Myers-Briggs measurement for that. It's interesting. In some sports, there are some interesting statistical measures that try to get at that. But I think that if you can sort of get a handle on that, like whose presence makes people better and put those people into management, and whose presence makes people worse, avoid them. But it's a great, great it's a great question. Thank you, Andy. It's a really fascinating question. Get Andy back on. Yeah, sorry, Andy. Go ahead, Bob.
One quick thing, following Dan's comment about, you know, the quick measure, there's some interesting research by Rob Cross at the University of Virginia that sort of suggests there's lots of different questions you might use. But the simple question that you can ask via survey or you can tell by nosing it around, which is after you interact with the person, do you have more or less energy? And he's got like about 50 companies he's done this. It's actually a pretty good predictor of who gets promotions, who is surrounded by more creative people, and a whole bunch of other positive things. It's not like a magic question that deals with all the issues, but it's not a bad place to start. And it's something I think we all can relate to. But it works, if you will, from a quantitative standpoint as well.
I think that's great to see. I think there was, I don't know whether Gallup did any research on that. I think there was a Gallup related book that came out, something like that, about filling people's buckets.
First break all the rules?
No, it was maybe it wasn't Gallup, but it had to do with the metaphor they used of, you know, people basically bucket fillers and bucket drainers. I've also seen it referred to as energy, like, I don't know, power plants and vampires. You know, one of them is
energizers and de-energizers.
Yeah, something like that. I think that's actually a big issue, and I think that we know in our midst who falls into what category. But I mean, oddly, there's a little bit of a knowing doing gap, because sometimes the person who we know falls into the energizer, make you perform better category, isn't the person who necessarily seems the most the perfect candidate on paper. And there's just so much risk aversion in hiring that we go with the person whom the hiring manager won't get in trouble for hiring. Andy, thanks for the call. We've got a few more here. What I want to do is I got to get to one more question for Bob here, which has to do with the book Good Boss, Bad Boss, which I thought was you know, just another really, really terrific book. And what really took away, there's sort of two takeaways. One of them is actually related to Andy's question, which is, it's related in a second cousin once removed sort of way, is this balancing act. Because a lot of this stuff and the way that you write about it, and I think the way that it's so accessible, is you talk about it in terms of these kinds of dichotomies or these balancing. And you talk in that thing about how, you know, sometimes managers, to be a good boss, you got to I don't want to say kick people's butt, but kick people's butt or have them, you know, like a lot of stuff you have to do is, as a manager, is say, how can I get other people to do things that are really not that wonderful and interesting and exhilarating? And yet, if that's all I do, I'm going to completely drain them of any kind of motivational energy. So how do I balance that with this idea of treating people well, helping them use their strengths, putting them in positions where they draw on intrinsic motivation and so forth. So why don't you talk a little bit about the balancing act, because I think that's a big part of good boss, bad boss.
And in fact, to your point, it's interesting that we almost named it. That means I wanted to name it that. My publisher wasn't so sure. We almost named the book Top Dog on a Tightrope. And a name which, by the way,
I'm so glad you called it Good Boss, Bad Boss.
Really? I like that name. Anyways, the guy who came up with
Top
it
Dog,
invented
it. There's a book. Uh-huh. Okay, now what do you call those books? What do you call those books? Remember like the Go Dog Go? What category is that? I'm asking my wife this question.
The easy readers.
Like there's a book called Go Dog Go.
Uh-huh.
That I must have read to our kids like 8,000 times.
Oh, okay.
Go Dog Go. And it's like Top Dog on a Tightrope.
But in any event, I could argue with myself over this too, by the way. So
I think it's already been decided.
It's already done. So
The
balancing act stuff, though, is it comes from two places. One I've already talked about a little bit, which is that there's a large body of research that shows that the best bosses are pretty good about knowing when to push and get in people's faces, to criticize them, to give them negative feedback, to coach them, versus just to get out of the way and let them work. And and that's back to this general notion of being in tune with what it feels like to work for me, that there's some people and some times when you've got to push the team, and there's some times when you've got to get out of the way. And people ask me how I do that. Well, you got to be confident enough to understand the motivations of the people right in front of you right now. But the other part, and I actually have a blog post that gets at this a little bit that I pulled up to the top just for this this show, it comes from one of my mentors in the management world, David Kelly, the main founder of IDEO and the main founder of the Stanford D School. Wonderful person.
Yeah.
And so years ago in the 90s when I first met David, he drew a little thing, and you can see it on my blog right now, which is that he put a heart in a dollar sign on sort of teeter-totter, and he talked about how there's a balancing act. And he talked about
excuse me, just for interrupting a little bit. So folks who are having a computer out there, just you go to Bob's site. If you just put into the Google "work matters," and it'll be the first thing. Work matters. I see Bob has a post up there with his drawing. Go ahead, Bob. I'm sorry.
Drawn by David Kelly himself, and David talked about that. You know, sometimes at IDEO, which is a famous innovation firm, there's times when you got to get people to do stuff for the money. You got to do deadlines. You got to give them work they don't want to do. You've got to push them to work harder. I mean, you've really got to get them to do stuff that is not that much fun. But he always has in his mind this notion that he's either got to build up points to burn, or he's got to sort of make up things that after he's put him in that situation, give him a fun project, give him light hours, maybe sometimes give him some money. Oh, that's not an IDEO thing. You would like IDEO really does focus on the intrinsics, which is if you get a lousy project that's no fun, but financially necessary, you will get something fun to do afterwards, generally, or something that fits your values and something that motivates you. And the thing that I like about David's perspective, and in some ways this gets to, you know, sort of the intrinsic extrinsic reward thing, which is that David's perspective is that right now, in the particular moment, you might not be able to provide the intrinsic rewards or the fun that people need. But if you look at it across a long time horizon, you got to make sure and insert those things at key points, even just for a few moments, he emphasizes, to sort of keep people rolling as part of the balancing, sort of almost like the moment-to-moment balancing act, in his words, between love and money. But and the love stuff is a lot of it is intrinsic.
Sure. And the thing is, I think that it seems like so much of this, I mean, ends up being this something along the lines of those balancing acts. The other thing about good boss, bad boss, and again, if you have, we have a lot of callers lined up, and forgive me because we're not going to be able to get to them all. But if you, anybody else who wants to hop in line, just press *2 to ask a question. *2. We've got people in Frederick, Maryland, Washington, Maryland, Huntington Beach, California, lined up here. We could use a few international. What else do we have here? We got people from all over the place here. Good God, Escondido, California. A lot of Californians here. Downers Grove, Illinois. That's probably close to where
you're. There's a lot of us.
Bonita Springs, Twin Cities, Madison, Wisconsin. We've got Madison, Wisconsin, State College, Pennsylvania. This is like the Big 10, Big 12 here, Big 11, whatever it is now.
Whatever they are.
Somebody from the – oh, here we go. It's close to you. Someone from the mean streets of Walnut Creek, California.
Oh, good.
Someone else.
Yes.
Someone else from the even meaner streets of Thousand Oaks, California. Someone else from the even – still meaner streets of Millbrae. My God, we got Silicon Valley here. Anyway, I digress. So the other thing here before we go to take some of these calls, Bob, is, and I think it's huge, and it actually, I'm excited because our guest next month is a woman, I'm sure you know, Teresa Mobley, who has a new book coming out.
Oh, yeah, Teresa's awesome. I just had dinner with her last month. She's awesome. Great book, Progress Principle. I recommend it.
Yeah,
fabulous book.
Yeah, the Progress Principle, we'll be talking about that next week. And so it's a and one of the things that you write about in Good Boss, Bad Boss, and that she writes about as well, is this notion of small wins.
Right.
I think that there's so much power in those small wins, and we overlook them. So why don't you give us a quick précis on small wins?
So this actually comes back, sort of the mother source of this is an article by a guy named Carl Weick, who's one of the sort of spirits of our field. And the basic idea is that is all this notion about big hairy goals, that sort of Jim Collins stuff. It's not like that stuff is wrong, but if you just give people a big hairy goal, there's actually a lot of evidence that they just freak out and freeze up. And so what the best leaders and organizations do is they find a way to help people break things into bite-sized pieces so they can make progress. And just, in fact, just last week, to give you, for those who are in the East Coast, a vivid example, some of you will recall in 2007 there was this horrible situation where literally thousands of people were stuck on planes at Kennedy and especially in JetBlue planes. And a friend of mine and former Stanford student, Bonnie Simi, Bonnie's amazing. She was also a three-time Olympian in the luge. So Bonnie led an effort with the JetBlue folks to figure out how to fix that problem. And the way that it started, and they tried a whole bunch of other top-down things that didn't work, was she got 40 or 50 key people in the room who were involved in the process and had them put a bunch of sticky notes that sort of laid out the whole process with all those little bite-sized pieces. And then she had them put, as I recall, they were pink stickies in the places where they anticipated problems, and they worked on those individual pink stickies. And that's an oversimplification, but not much. Yeah. But it's a classic thing of taking a very difficult problem. I mean, everybody knew the big hairy goal was to fix Kennedy, but and also irregular operations at other airports when they're shut down by weather. But the thing about that is that if you look at the amount of time people spent, they knew what the big goal was. Okay, we know what the big hairy goal is.
Right now,
Google, they know the big hairy goal is to beat Facebook and in the social stuff. I mean, I think everybody knows that. The fact that all of their money is focused on that. But what really matters if they're going to do it, and who knows if they'll do it, are those little tiny wins. So, and Teresa's evidence is, even by the standards of stuff published in the best academic journals, is beyond amazing. I mean,
I agree with that.
We'll learn more about it next month.
But I think there's something profound about the methodological approach you took to gathering it, and which that's just a tantalizing sneak preview for next month. But it really shows that making progress is inherently motivating. I think it's a huge insight. Anyway, we're gonna we don't have a huge amount of time left, so we're just gonna go. We're going to go to the phones. I don't have a first name here, but let's go to nearby to me, Frederick, Maryland. Frederick, Maryland, are you still there?
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Welcome to Office
Hours.
Tell us your first name.
Hi. You're going to be speaking with Frederick County Public Schools next month, so we're looking forward to that.
Oh, well, thanks, I am. I'm looking forward to that. Frederick County, Maryland is right here in the Washington metropolitan area, for those of you who aren't privileged to live here. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Well, tell us your first name and what's your question?
My name is Kathy, and my question is this. I have two questions real quick. One, out of the Covey book, he talks about that like 37% of people or organizations have a clear understanding of what they're trying to achieve, and he goes on and it's the eighth habit, and 15% felt that their work was, that they worked in a trusted environment, da-da-da-da. And he says if, say, a soccer team had these same scores, only 4 of the 11 players on the field would know which goal is theirs. Only 2 of the 11 would care, and only 2 of the 11 would know what position they play. So that's just, you know, staggering kinds of things to think about in major organizations that people are working under conditions that they really don't know what they're doing. And so that's a whole other thing as far as there's a lot of literature about what to do about that. The school system a whole other book could be written about that too.
Sure. So based on that Covey insight, what's your question for Bob?
Well, you know what? Just a quick personal question. If I want to get, I'm a guidance counselor in the school system, and I would like to get into, I'd like to make a career change and get into organizational development and like another master's degree or something. Where should I go to school?
Bob, where should she go to school?
but you know, my reaction is that it's hard to figure out what to do, but I think some of the best MBA programs are actually pretty good about handling that sort of issue. Sort of on ramp to a good program. So I'd get into the best MBA program in the best school I could, frankly, for that.
Yeah, and here in the DC metropolitan area where the caller is from, there are a lot of good. I mean, if you're a teacher or guidance counselor, you're working your butt off all day. But there are a lot of good evening programs at here at Georgetown, and also University of Maryland. Robert Smith has an excellent program for those kinds of folks. So fantastic. Thanks for the question. Let's go to Jonathan in Newton, New Jersey. Jonathan in Newton, you're on the air.
How are you today?
I'm good. What's your question for Bob or me or for the world?
My question is, I am an a-hole in reform currently.
You would be more of the New York variety than the California variety.
Well, he's got some self-awareness. I congratulate you. Pardon?
No, the book was recommended to me by my boss at the company I work with. I'm in sales, marketing, and business development. I'm historically a top performer, but also can be a pain in the ass. Uh-huh. And I think a lot of the challenges that we face is my urgency is perceived as impatience. And I was wondering if you had some comments on how to navigate that.
Oh, man.
Before you get advice from Bob, you say your urgency is perceived as impatience. What are the roots of your urgency? Why do you feel that sense of urgency?
Oh, we're just not realizing. The amount of potential we have relative to the amount of potential we realize, the gap is way too big.
So you're excited, rather. It's an urgency that comes from feeling excited about the possibilities.
And simple problems that have fairly easy and obvious solutions, if you're willing to think about them in a big picture, rather than micromanage these problems, that you don't even see the big picture. It's the forest for the trees.
Okay. And your question for Bob was?
Helping people that are perceiving urgency for impatience and get frustrated.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. Bob, what do you think?
So I have two reactions. And first of all, I appreciate you being straightforward about this, since many of us, including me at times, by the way, who have the overbearing jerk problem, sometimes don't admit it or aren't aware of it. So I appreciate you being sensitive to the fact that, and I'm not kidding too, because it's hard for us human beings to do that, both to admit it and to be aware of it. The first thing that comes to mind is if you're in a situation where you're just trying to convey urgency and the person you're dealing with thinks that you're being a jerk, it means there's a disconnect in how you're perceiving it. So you might either want to have – and I, by the way, I have a friend at Stanford whose job it is to tell me when I'm being an asshole in part. He's very good at it. So having somebody else around who can sort of perceive the situation and sort of give you the feedback you actually were pushing a little bit too hard. And then the other thing for me is it sounds like you're in a situation where you have some authority over the person who's doing it. If that's correct, is that sort of giving them permission to do something like hold up their hand or do a time outside to just give you a sign that this is a little bit too tough for me at the moment. And so that's sort of like allowing the feedback to come there. On the other hand, and to do the other side of the coin, that knowing if you're in like a sales type position, sales environments are tough. And there's a certain level of intensity that is required to make it in that sort of occupation. So there's also like a selection issue that sometimes people will perceive that their boss is a jerk or is overly time urgent when it's simply the nature of the work to perform. And to me, a lot of that gets on the sort of hiring, who you hire, and the expectations you set for them of how it's going to be. And I work with two great people at Stanford, Perry Claiborne and Jeremy Utley, who do very intense time pressure stuff. And they're really good. They're always warning everybody, this is the way the game is. It's going to happen fast. You're going to feel neglected. I'm not going to talk to you. I'm going to rush by. I'm going to expect you to get stuff done right now. That's just the way that we roll. This thing doesn't work. And so there's the other part about
really
that is setting the expectations with the people you hire and along the way that this is the nature of the business. And it is sort of weird. If you're the kind of person who's never hurried and harried and been in a rush and then you're thrown in that environment, you might think everybody is assholes where they're just busy.
Right. So, right. That's great. That's excellent advice. Thanks, Jonathan, for the call. We're going to try to squeeze in one more here from Washington, Maryland. Washington, Maryland, if you're with us, tell us who you are and what's your question. Washington, Maryland.
Oh, we lose him?
Hello, Washington. It looks like we lost Washington, Maryland here. Sorry about that. I think that might have been user error here on the part of our crack team here. So we only have, actually, Bob, like 2 or 3 minutes left.
Sure.
As I mentioned, the Ed McMahon of Office Hours and the person who's looking at some of these calls is my wife, whom I've mentioned several times, the former, and I just want to make sure, former lawyer. But she actually had a really interesting, as I told you before, she loved your book, and she had a question. I think it's partly answered in the book, but I think that the other callers, other listeners might like it. So I'm going to put this is Jessica. So, Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi, Bob.
Oh, hi, Jessica. Hi. Oh, wow. It's great to talk to you.
So this is our last question.
Okay, so Bob.
Yes.
Most of us know that more men than women are a-holes.
Mm-hmm.
In your experience, do women tend to be better bosses than men, or would you not go out there and say
well,
such
you
thing?
Know. There is some interesting new evidence, by the way, that shows that, and it's amazing stuff. It's on sort of like collective intelligence or team smartness. That you can find this in the Harvard Business Review if you just look around. That teams that have a higher proportion of women do better across a wide range of tasks. So there is some evidence to support that. But there is a problem that women face more severely than men, and I'm going to go back to annoy you with the top dog is a tightrope thing. And this comes, you know, from my wife, who last job was running a large law firm, and now she's CEO of the Northern California Girl Scouts. She's always been a boss. She can tell you this, and there's a lot of academic literature that shows the problem that women face is that, well, it's actually unclear whether a larger percentage of women or men are assholes. The numbers look like a little bit higher percentage of men are assholes than women, but not dramatically,
really?
as you might think. There's some good national survey data that shows that the main thing it shows is that women mostly
like
dump on women
shocking,
and men mostly dump
that.
On men. But yeah. That's in large part because of the fact of just the structure of occupations. But the problem that women has, and one reason that they may get more blame than they deserve is there's a lot of evidence, and I'm going to use that that women sort of walk a much narrower sort of tightrope in terms of coming across as either being a doormat or a bitch. And it turns out that we men, since we get off easier and all sorts of things in life, it's hard for us to be viewed as sort of like easier for us to be viewed as sort of like competent but civilized, whereas women, when they start getting a little bit pushy and assertive, they start getting labeled as a bitch. And it really is a problem, in both men and women construe this about this sort of gender issue. So the challenge that women faces, and this is a problem for society, by the way, is we've got to sort of realize that that on the whole, that we're not giving women as much leeway as we are men, and we're being actually sexist against us, and this includes women are sexist against women bosses. So that, to me, that's in some ways one of the biggest problems. But having said that, I mean, there's pretty good evidence, including this new set of studies, which are amazing, very carefully done, that the more women are in your group, the smarter it is. And then there's also some other cool evidence that comes from a guy named Boris Groysberg at Harvard Business School that shows that female superstars are more portable than male superstars because they have better interpersonal skills. So that's
interesting. It's interesting. I've just read a couple of his papers, and and you know, his big idea is he looks at, I guess he leads a study of most famous for a study of analysts at banks, and found that the superstar analysts, when they move from bank one to bank two, were no longer superstars. because a lot of their success was context, dependent on context,
right,
relationship, all those sorts of things that we don't typically take seriously enough. Unbelievably, though, as much as I want to continue to talk, that was an interesting perspective on that. It actually made me – I think you're absolutely right that women have far less leeway. I just think about the women I've known who've been managers or sort of even senior leaders. They are truly walking a tightrope where the men have a, you know, four-lane highway sometimes. So we're at the top of the hour, and I want to respect our call. I want to respect everybody's time and also the constraints of iTunes. So we're going to have to wrap up here, Bob.
Thanks.
That's it for Office Hours. Thanks for being with us, Bob. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Everybody here, this program will be available for download for free in a few days at dantink.com.
That's it for Office Hours. Thanks for being with us. To learn more about Bob Sutton, just Google Work Matters. Work Matters, where you can find his blog as well as his many books. Next month on Office Hours, we'll be talking to Teresa Amabile, a professor at Harvard Business School and co-author of the new book, The Progress Principle. We'll be announcing that date and time in a few days. Until then, for producer Joseph Hinson in Lynchburg and director Jessica Lerner here at World Headquarters, I'm Daniel Pink. You've been listening to Office Hours. If you've missed an episode, check us out on iTunes.